You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 157.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You've reached another Local Maximum. How you doing? Very excited to start off the show today. This is going to be an exciting show. Hey, Aaron.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's been a weird week, but good to be talking with you again.
So have you ever heard of something called the Strauss-Howe generational theory?
I have. I think we may have discussed it in one of our pre-show bits briefly, and I've heard it as kind of the counter to the great man theory of history, that there are trends that pay heed to no man and that are out of the control of the individual.
Wait. Well, you're confusing me here. No. I see what you're saying. Right. So a lot of these theories of history, I find them absolutely fascinating, but also as a an inference guy, as a science, scientific minded person, I always find a little bit of skepticism within me of all of these theories. But it is sort of a theory of how historical trends might work. Or I guess they're not historical trends, just ongoing trends might work over the course of, say, like hundreds of years or generations. And this one is a very interesting one because it predicts that it predicts like a giant kind of revolutionary period every 80 years, every lifetime, essentially. And we're in the midst of one right now. If you think about it, we had here in the U.S. and here in the West, we had 80 years ago, we had the Great Depression and World War II. Remember that? I mean, I know we don't remember that, but we probably know someone who remembers that.
I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah. And then 80 years before that, there was the Civil War, and I believe a bunch of stuff went down in Europe as well. And then 80 years before that, you had the American Revolution. And 80 years before that, it doesn't really fit that well in 1700. But if you go back to 1690, there were actually revolts all throughout the colonies. And, governors were replaced. And in England, they had their glorious revolution and whatever. So, okay. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people hear that and they're like, boom, I'm sold. This sounds amazing. But the problem is, there are also a lot of events that could be thought of as, big, what they call fourth turning events. In other words, they have like four generations between each one and each one is called a turning. So, it's like, well, where does World War I fit in? Where do other big changes fit in? And so it could just be a coincidence of history.
Yeah,
so
there's certainly a danger of kind of confirmation bias that once you're aware of the pattern, you can find things that fit it, and it's very easy to ignore the things that maybe don't so much fit it and emphasize those that do.
Yeah, so the reason why I want to bring it up today is just because, well, first of all, they came out with this in, I think it was, at least 15 years ago. It might have been like the early 2000s. So, right.
This was the original, I assume it was Strauss and Howe were the researchers.
Yeah. So it is a point for them that the instability we're experiencing now is stuff that they predicted, before it happened. But I count that as data that supports the theory, but not by no means overwhelming data. But it certainly is interesting because I read about this before then. And so if their timeline is to be believed, if we say 40 years from 1945, then, we reach this grand finale in 2025, which is, isn't this fun? We're going to have five more years of this, whatever this is.
Yeah, well, and it raises the question, so where does something like 9/11 and the global war on terror fit into this cycle? Does that fit the sequence of events, or do we have to consider that that's not really a turning event?
No, that's a third turning event. That's like an unraveling. So it's like, they would have the third turning be between, say, 1985 and 2005. So I'm not too familiar with exactly what that means, but that's sort of when.
But they're saying we're in the midst the lead of up the crisis to, here.
Right, right. The 20 years before is sort of the lead up to the crisis, and I guess that 9/11 was a part of that. And I guess the argument would be that if 9/11 happens now, it would be like the, it would be the event that sparked everything versus 9/11 in actuality sparked some things, but it didn't. I would argue it when 9/11 happened, people were like, oh, my God, our lives are changed forever and our government has changed forever. Well, a little bit, but it wasn't like the it wasn't the spark that brought the whole thing down to its knees by a long shot. No, if that makes sense.
Not in one fell swoop, certainly. If it was, then it was the spark that triggered a long smoldering process of decades.
Yeah. No, I actually don't think that 9/11 is the cause of. We haven't even gotten into what I'm talking about in terms of like instability right now, which is really interesting. People could be thinking about a number of things. We're going to talk today about our monetary and financial system. That's fun. We're going to talk about Bitcoin. We're going to talk about GameStop. People could be talking about our political system and all that. Or academia, or there's so many things that could fit this mold, really. But I think that, where was I going with this? It was just,
What is the context for our Strauss Howe generational theory discussion here?
Right. I think we're going to have a few of them. And so today I want to talk about monetary theory. So, personally, I actually think if this theory works that like Eastern Europe seems to be one generation behind. I'm surprised they don't say this because it feels like they had the Russian Revolution during World War One, and their fourth turning kind of feels like the fall of communism, which is actually a pretty good. I mean, it was chaos over there, but as far as fourth turning goes, it's that's not so bad.
Yeah, well, I jumped to that conclusion when you mentioned the Civil War being one of our fourth turnings here in the West, because 1848 was the big year of revolutions in Europe. So that's
right.
Roughly a generation before that. Things get a little fuzzy.
I
think there's an interesting discussion to be made about, will we see these timelines accelerating as so many things have accelerated with the increased speed of communication and globalization, or generations or generations, whether they're, pre-electricity or post-internet.
Right, because it's the people. It's the people involved. But I that kind of makes me skeptical of the theory, because then if you could shove things around in them, if it's 10 years before, 10 years after, who cares, then you're kind of making the theory difficult to falsify.
Well, yeah, a generation is a pretty large window, as anyone who's tried to define what a millennial is.
Right.
It's very fuzzy.
Yeah. So anyway, I listened to a podcast recently. It was called Why Bitcoin Wins. The podcast called Why Bitcoin Wins. Or sorry, the podcast is called What Bitcoin Did. The episode was called Why Bitcoin Wins. This is Gary
Who
v
did
and,
what now?
And, yeah, by Gary V and Robert Breedlove. But the question that I found interesting is not why Bitcoin wins, but what does it look like if it does win? Because I can imagine, hey, you've got Bitcoin, it's the global standard, or some other cryptocurrency or some digital currency or whatever. You always have to caveat that. But the shocking changes that have to happen in between to get from here to there are hard to cope with in my mind. And I was hoping we could discuss that today. And that's sort of where I kind of fit that in with the fourth turning. I just thought that... I thought, hey, generational theory maybe predicts this. So that's pretty cool.
So are we talking about the question of not just will Bitcoin or digital currency or blockchain, crypto for more general term there. That's what I was looking for. Will that become not so much will that become a standard, but what kind of event leads to it? Is there going to be some sort of total
not
collapse,
just what...
or will it be a gradual transition, or
exactly the predictions of currency collapse, I should point out, are nothing new. There's a book from 1980. I guess I'll link to it in the show notes page, The Coming Currency Collapse and What You Can Do About It. That was written 40 years ago. I wasn't even born yet.
Now, I assume that was written about the dollar, because there are definitely currencies that have collapsed, but not the dollar, at least not in as obvious a way as that would imply.
It was written in wake of the inflation of the late 70s. So, yeah, I guess they thought that it was coming faster. But if you read the reviews on Amazon, a lot of people are like, you know, there's very few people who are like, oh, this is a bunch of crap. There are actually a lot of people who are saying, oh, it's just delayed. It's still going to happen. It's inevitable, which is interesting. It's an interesting kind of human psychology thing where they're kind of these permanent sky is falling type people in terms of the currency. And so I don't want to be one of those. So it is important to point out that, these predictions are not new. And so I don't know if the first of all, does the currency have to collapse? Does the dollar have to collapse for us to have a Bitcoin standard? Yeah, I mean,
it sounds like it could very easily be playing on the same impulses that make us susceptible to things like doomsday cults.
Right.
That there's something very appealing about both the prospect and the explanation for how we're going to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, it's, you know, if the US government decided to go back on the gold standard, which is not easy to do, although I think, Alexander Hamilton might have been the last person to do it to bring country back in the gold standard. That doesn't mean the currency collapses, right? So if you had a Bitcoin standard or even a hybrid Bitcoin gold standard, it doesn't mean the currency collapses or, you know, so I don't know.
But you would expect there's going to be some shocks in that transition.
Yeah, yeah. And so and something's got to shock the system into doing it. Like, they're not going to do this, just because someone asks nicely.
Right, yeah.
Politicians don't
want... It seems
want...
unlikely that they would put that the genie of what is it, fractional reserve banking, back into the bottle if they don't absolutely have to. The threatening of everything that they've come to believe in and build their society on, they being the economic infrastructure, would put them into that position.
And there are really no politicians or very few politicians who want to touch this stuff right now.
Yeah, well, and
for either party.
Economists don't become politicians, and I don't know what that says, but I feel like there's something to be gleaned.
Well, some of them do. But not so much in the United States. Actually, I think that's more like in other countries you have economists as politicians.
Certainly as technocrats, but I feel like as politicians, less so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why is it? It's blanking on my mind, but I feel like there are certain like African leaders who are economists, and
That may be the case.
I think I was watching The Crown. I think one of the British prime ministers was an economist. I think Howard Wilson. I don't think I'm saying that right. Some guy from the 70s.
I would believe that because I have a completely based on anecdotal evidence impression that Oxford and Cambridge output some sort of disproportionate number of economists to what a standard American university might do. That may be completely faulty conclusion to draw there, but it's something that I would rank as believable.
Wait, what was the conclusion?
I feel like Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, they output a much higher percentage of economists than a American university of equal caliber. So there's probably a lot more of them in Europe than there are in the US, and at that kind of upper tier of education, which tends to feed into people in government at that level.
Right.
And
people in government, right. When I went to Yale, there were a lot of econ majors, but they weren't the people going into government.
Right. Well, and I would say that,
people going into finance.
If you were from a family that was connected and or wealthy in Africa or certain parts of Asia, that's where you went to school. So
right.
you got pumped into that system. I don't know how true that actually ever was and how true it is today, but it's certainly the impression that I'm carrying around in my head.
Me too. it's Yeah, it's pretty true. I mean, one of the things you realize, like you know, because I went to Yale, and one of the things you realize is you can be very successful with that education, but a lot of it is some of the people there. I mean, well, okay, I don't want to be like,
It's not all networking, but it's not all networking.
No, I'm not even going to say that. Some of it is just the connections, the family connections, and the wealth that people who are there already have. And so if you don't have that, you know, you could still make a get huge benefit from that education, although people are going to, you know, argue with me then. But I know I did. But it was like, okay, you know, some of the people there were already set up with, hey, you know, if I want to start a business, their family can lend them $500,000, and they've got, you know, all the connections. And
yeah, well, it's the...
It doesn't mean...
The expression of starting on third base.
A lot of the politicians, especially. Yeah, a lot of the politicians, especially. Well, yeah, and not, you know, it's not that.
Yeah, well, because ladder climbing is an intergenerational endeavor that yeah. Rarely do you go from the bottom to the top in a single lifetime.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, but that's not that's not related.
Completely
to...
Completely off topic.
Yeah, that's a little off topic.
So Bitcoin.
Right. So, right. Okay. I just want to remind people about how fast this thing's moved. I don't think it's going to take 40 years. If you remember back to 2013, 2014, I mean, some people have asked me more recently, like, Max, you knew about Bitcoin back then. Why didn't you tell me to invest? And the answer is, well, I kind of did tell people to, but I didn't push it that hard because a lot of my Facebook friends and people in the media were telling me, like, you know, it's a scam and it's evil, and this is going to be one of those things that, you know, you're going to realize how stupid you are later. And like, it was kind of getting to me a little bit. I didn't believe it, but I was like, ooh, I'm not going to be that guy who pushes everyone just to make sure. And in fact, I even applied that to myself. Like, I didn't overinvest it, you know? So it's like, I probably should have, but, whatever. So it has come so far in just a few short years, and it shows no sign of stopping. And so what, you know, at some point there are going to be political and economic earthquakes if this thing has, I don't know, well, what's the market cap now? Let me just check it real quick. Just for comparison's sake. So the market cap right now.
So market cap is going to be the dollar equivalent of the current right. holdings. Does this account right. for lost and abandoned Bitcoin?
Yes. Yeah. So it might actually be, well, it's hard to say. So it's more of a order of magnitude measure.
Gotcha.
But let's say right now it's $700 billion. So, you know, it'll clearly be $1 trillion. What happens if it's 10 trillion? You know, what happens if it's 100 trillion? Then you start getting into, you know, okay, all of the you know, like it, in everyone's funds are invested in this thing. And then you start having, governments being invested in this thing as holdings, just like they hold gold. And in fact, I believe that we're actually pretty close to having some local governments and municipalities in the United States try this out. And I think that there's a good reason for it. So there's one article I want to call attention to. It's the Miami mayor says that city employees should be able to take their salaries in Bitcoin. That's Miami. That is a big city. And it's a city that's doing well right now. And it's a city that wants to become the next tech hub. Honestly, I think I could live in Miami. What do you think? I don't think that would be that bad.
I can't say that I've spent much time there, but the big question that pops to mind, and maybe the article addresses this, does that mean that they get their salary set in Bitcoin, or their salary is set in dollars,
no.
but at the time of payment, it is converted to Bitcoin?
It's the time and payment for sure. I already know that. I don't even have to look at the article because they wouldn't do that with, you know,
Well, you can certainly negotiate that. I think a lot of freelancers have experimented with that type of thing. Particularly if you're freelancing internationally, you can.
Yeah, but government is government. Let's not push it that far.
Government. Well, you know, kind of came up with the original concept of, I'm going to give you this piece of paper that I say is worth something, but it's only actually worth what I'm willing to redeem it for at a later date so I can change my mind.
Right. Right. So there have been companies that have invested in Bitcoin. I'm just going to give, the big one right now is MicroStrategy. But, you know, there's some rumors maybe Elon Musk might do it. And so, sometimes instead of holding cash, they might hold Bitcoin. People, you know, just a few years ago would have said, that's insane. You know, the company should not be investing in Bitcoin. They should have their cash in dollars because their investors don't want to invest in Bitcoin. But now, people are changing their mind. And I even think a city like Miami might try to do it. And I think some states might try to do it. And you know what I think might be a catalyst for this is if the, during the pandemic, some places locked down really hard and, destroyed all their businesses with the hopes that, hey, we're going to get a federal bailout later. And, you know, now it looks like those bailouts might come. And I feel like some of the places that stayed open, like Miami, like Florida, might say, you know what? If you're going to give all of our dollars to states that, didn't let their businesses operate, well, maybe we'll just invest in Bitcoin and, you know, let Bitcoin rise in relation to the dollar. I think there might be appetite for a revolt of that nature on the local level, which honestly would be a lot more effective than
curious what the mechanism there would be for because the way you phrased it, it sounds like almost trying to protect themselves from the abuse of the federal government. But what about Bitcoin lets them do that?
So no, the federal government will still collect income taxes and whatnot from that state. Like it's not, you know, they're not protecting their assets or their people's assets from the federal government. But what they are doing is they are saying, hey, the federal government is doing these bailouts on credit, right? It's going to be all credit. It's all going to be, let's print $1 trillion. Let's print another $1 trillion. And, we'll deal with it. Our monetary system can handle it, presumably. And we'll just pass these dollars out to the areas that need it.
If states maintained a large treasury, I could see that being a valid path. But my impression is that most states have a small to medium rainy day fund. And other than that, it's money in, money out, that they struggle to keep a balanced budget, never mind to accumulate a long-term surplus. That would be the exception, though, is pensions. And maybe that's not so much the state, but public sector unions tend to be some of the biggest groups that still actually have pensions. Man. And that's a lot of money to throw around.
Yeah, that would be the ultimate Hail Mary pass. Like our pensions are, a lot of times the pensions are not. We don't have enough to pay for the pension fund. The pension fund is not solvent. All right, let's put it all in Bitcoin and see if we can save.
But the purpose of the pension, right, is to beat inflation. Right. So that and if they're concerned about money printer go burr, that there's going to be huge, modern monetary theory and inflationary, quantitative easing or whatnot, then that may be an excellent way to hedge that for the pensions.
Right. Right. No, but,
if they make the move, if the big institutional pensions go into that, then I think it won't be too long after that. Then you start seeing, maybe not, individual retail level, but, you may see a Fidelity or I'm blanking on some of the other big 401k managing companies, having essentially the equivalent of like a mutual fund or a targeted retirement fund that has a huge chunk of Bitcoin in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's probably going to happen sooner.
Because I don't know about you, but I've never worked anywhere that's actually had a pension program. So,
yeah, a 401k. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I do think, though, you talk about these rainy day funds and you talk about, holdings that these states have. I think some states are going to decide, yeah, let's have some holdings in Bitcoin some city funds because they have something there. And they're like, hey, you know what? Let's let's it's the thought of a state or a city betting against the dollar would have been crazy, I think, just a few years ago. Now it seems almost within the Overton window, because people are so fed up, and just buying Bitcoin doesn't seem that radical. It seems like a rather peaceful way of going about things. That could be interesting. And I actually think that if it starts to harm the dollar, that is when maybe politicians on the federal level might step up and it might force their hands to do something about it. Or they might screw it all up. It's we don't know.
So I was,
this could come to a head at some point.
We were talking about institutional investors. And...
Oh, by the way, before you get into that, the term is called hyper Bitcoinization. It's the idea that everything gets turned over to this one asset, which is the hardest asset. Again, I don't want to be say it's definitely going to happen, but it's very interesting to think about. And the idea of people who support this theory is like, yeah, it's going to happen very fast, and it's going to happen, you know, somewhere around 2025 to 2029.
I don't know that we are headed to a future where everything is done in Bitcoin, but I could easily see a future where Bitcoin functionally replaces the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. That not everything is done in Bitcoin, but everything is benchmarked to Bitcoin.
That and what does that mean for us in the U.S. Like functionally?
Well, that is perhaps a better alternative if you accept the forecast that many people are making that we're going to lose reserve currency status here in the U.S. that the dollar is on an inevitable downslope and it's just a question of how long. Then perhaps Bitcoin stepping into that role or some other form of crypto is a superior option for us as Americans than China or some other nation stepping up and taking that role.
Oh, yeah. Much better. Like, would you rather be governed by China or Russia or by math, essentially? But the question is, you know, what does that mean for us economically? Because I'm not really sure. Like, does that mean that we have, I'm still uncertain, like, whether that means we have unemployment, jobs leaving the country, at least in the short term, or not. It's definitely going to be a shock if it happens, an economic shock. And that always includes some economic pain for a lot of people. It might not be economic pain for me or you, particularly if I successfully, as I do the research on this program, kind of anticipate where we're going. It could mean very good things for me and for the listeners of this show. But, for people in this country in general, it could mean a lot of people are going to get hurt when things aren't done the way they're used to. Not too many hold all their savings in dollars anymore. So I'm not so sure.
Yeah, well, and so we were talking about pensions and big institutional investors and how maybe some states have these large rainy day funds, but many don't necessarily have those kind of large holdings. But you know who does have large rainy day funds or large endowments? Ivy League universities. So while we were talking, I went and checked, and there's actually an article from the end of January indicating that Harvard, Yale, and Brown, among other Ivy League universities, have been buying up Bitcoin as part of their endowment for over a year at this point. You know, not just getting donated Bitcoin by the occasional alumni, but literally buying through public exchanges. So if they're starting to move in that direction, then that's a huge vote of confidence in this as a reasonable hedge against wherever the economy is going, because they don't screw around
so
with billion-dollar endowments.
I can't emphasize enough. Just a few years ago, this was like Mt. Gox exploded. You know, this is it. You know, Bitcoin is made to be stolen and made to be a scam, which of course it isn't. It's just, hey, could it have been any other way if Bitcoin was introduced in the market and then the first few things that popped up were scams, like when there hasn't been, you know, When there hasn't been like market pressure against
that. If one of the trustees of the Harvard Endowment came into a board meeting and suggested, you know, we should really put some of our funds into Bitcoin at that point, they would have submitted him for mental review to send him off to the psych hospital.
It was magic internet money. Yeah. But I remember people like using the way I think about it, like, imagine if you're living in a world where Bitcoin has already taken over, for lack of a better term, and you read the history of how it started. The history would not say, oh, yeah, it was introduced and it just kept going and going without any problems until it took over. It's like, no, like there are growing pains. And so I suspected at the time that Mt. Gox exploded. I was looking at it and people were like, yep. This is the end. This is the end of everything. And I was like, well, wait, let's see if this coin survives, because then there'll be another crop of, Bitcoin companies. And then some of them will go out of business, and there's still scams around it even today. There always will be. But as the organizations that do it get bigger and bigger and more reliant on brands, then dare I say regulated, I hate this term, but like, I mean, like, you know, someone being like, hey, I am operating under the laws of the United States, and I'm here, and there's really very little I can do to kind of just steal your stuff. I've done X, Y, and Z to basically make it impossible or extremely unlikely, so it's crazy how fast these things moved. And it's amazing the number of people just a few years ago who saw these initial blow-ups and used that as an excuse to say it's all dead. And the fact that it's moving so fast is just, it's just unbelievable. And it seems to be moving faster and faster in 2021.
Yeah, and it's not unusual for, the nerdy types to be at the cutting edge of this type of stuff. Most famously, Isaac Newton was master of the mint for the Royal Mint in Great Britain right before, what was it? It was 1699 and around then. I don't know much about what exactly he did in that role, but it's an interesting tidbit there.
He was pocketing some money, I think.
Well, he certainly got a nice salary off of that. But, polymaths pound, all around.
Pounds for me, a pound for the economy. Pound for me, a pound for the economy. No, I don't know. It's interesting. Well, I think, mathematicians back then, even theoretical mathematicians, were probably a lot more likely to get their hands dirty with that kind of thing, just accounting, because that would have been probably a much bigger deal back then for someone to even be able to do accounting. Maybe not by 1699, but certainly in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
I don't know. My history is a little weird on that.
Well, so how do we tie this into the other major story of the last 2 weeks?
Which is GameStop.
Yes.
So some people are saying it ties in. Let's talk about it and see if it does tie in. I'm not so sure. First, I guess I should summarize GameStop either. I feel like I've listened to
if you're
like
first
10...
hearing about it here, then I don't know where you've been. But yeah, give the Cliff Notes version.
Right. Okay. So, we don't know. I feel like I've listened to 10 podcasts on GameStop already, and everyone's talking about it, so I feel like everyone knows. But GameStop is a video game company.
They are the Blockbuster of video games.
Yes, you might find their stores at the mall, although they're not like Blockbuster in that they're still around.
Barely.
It kind of feels like they're out of the 90s, right? It feels like it feels like something like that. So they're a publicly traded company, and they are heavily shorted by hedge funds. Shorting means that they're betting the stock that is going to go down. They're borrowing the stock in hopes that the stock goes down. So then when they buy it back later to return the stock, they'll buy it back at a lower price. And some people on Reddit, Wall Street Bets, which is a pretty big subreddit. It's got a lot of people in there. someone discovered that it is very heavily shorted. In fact, the short positions taken out on GameStop are more than the entire value of the company, which just means very heavily shorted. That actually confused me at first. Did that confuse you at first when they said, because I don't have
yeah,
you heard that they
were I saw the 138% thrown around, which seemed right. wrong at first. But and it's certainly a red flag. I've heard that anything over like 20% of the value of the company being shorted is unusually high.
Right.
But it's not impossible, because when you borrow right. that share to short it, and you know, you borrow it to sell, and then whoever you sold it to could then lend it out to somebody else. So the same share can be shorted multiple times.
Right, right. So some people have come out and said, oh, if they're shorted 138% or whatever that is, then they'll never be able to give back the shares. But that's not entirely true.
Right, because and not all of those shorts come due at the same time.
Yeah. Right, you could give back one share and then buy it back later, and then give it back again. But it is still pretty crazy that you could be shorted that much. And so the people on Wall Street Bets, whether it was to make money or to stick to the hedge funds, I guess, were like, let's all invest in this.
It can be two things.
Yeah, yeah. Let's all invest in this. Let's drive the price up, and let's drive them out of business. And it cost them, I think, on the order of like $50 billion or something crazy like that, because the price of GameStop just had like a short squeeze where demand for the stock, the supply was so low and the demand went so high, and there were so many GameStop hodlers being like, I'm going to buy a bunch of GameStop and I won't sell no matter what, that the price just went from something like 18 at the beginning of the year, and actually it was only $5 you know, in the middle of 2020. So this kind of was a slow rolling thing. People were starting to notice it in the summer of last year, but nobody really knew. So it went from 5 to 18 last year. Then it went to 18 to like 450, and now it's fluctuating very, very much up and down and up and down.
Right.
GameStop, the fundamentals are clearly not worth that much, but it's really, really, you know, it's causing some of these hedge funds.
Yeah, ignoring for a moment the 138% shorting of the stock, or whatever that number turned out to actually be. The fundamentals, it made sense to short. There was a turnaround effort underway, but it seemed likely that it was a reasonable bet to be making that it was overvalued where it was.
But
fundamentals are a long-term indicator, not a short-term indicator, as we've seen in the last 2 weeks.
Right, right. So I think Melvin Capital was the name of the hedge fund. They're real people. They have names. There are people who work there. I once got a job offer at a hedge fund. I didn't end up taking it. But I guess I wouldn't have been invested in the hedge fund. I would have just been doing statistical models for them. Although I'm sure my bonus would have been based on the amount they made. But there's this hedge fund, 0.72, which is invested in Melvin Capital. And you know, they probably lost a bunch on this, but I heard they raised more. It's such an enormous hedge fund that it doesn't register for them, probably. Well, it registers, but it doesn't kill them off for sure. You know, this whole thing reminds me of, there's a question of what the meaning of this is. I think that there's a lot of people who ascribe meaning to this event. Like, is it the revolt of the little guys taking down the big hedge funds once and for all? Well, you know, there are examples of just crazy things that happen in the financial markets from time to time. Nassim Taleb talks about them. They're called black swans. I mean, black swan is broader than that, but he noticed them certainly in financial markets. It kind of reminded me of a company called Long Term Capital Management. Have you ever heard of that one?
No, I'm not familiar with them.
Okay, so there's a book on it. It's called When Genius Failed. The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. I read that a couple years ago. And, you know, Yeah, they're one of the funds that really screwed up. I think they had like $4 billion and they were leveraged $125 billion or something like that. And they used all these mathematical models. And I think, to make a long story short, they assumed some things were, some variables were independent when they were not. Mm. So they thought that something had a one in quadrillion chance when really it had a much better, higher chance of happening.
And, yeah, well, I mean, fundamentally, the idea of a hedge fund is that they're supposed to be hedged in each direction. But
yeah, that's where the names comes from.
But the more you chase the big gains, the faster and looser you play with you know, covering yourself with hedges. And clearly, these guys did not cover their full downside at Melvin.
Yeah, at Melvin or at long-term capital management, right. Which was in 1997. So again, if this could happen in 1997, again though. What was going on in 1997? We were also in the middle of a little bit of a financial bubble in 97, right? And then one of the shocks came of the Asian financial crisis, which is what led to their fall. One of my takeaways from the books, I don't remember all the specifics there, but it's not like all of the hedge funds are in it together and they're like, help a buddy out. No,
certainly not.
If some of the funds sees that one struggling, they will go after it like sharks.
Yeah,
they will
blood
pick
in the
it
water,
apart.
For sure.
Yeah, so it's not just the little guys that'll go after you.
Which makes it surprising that that Melvin basically got bailed out by a bigger fund. But I'm sure that bigger fund is extracting their pound of flesh for doing so.
Oh, yeah, that's what they do, yeah. And I'm surprised that other funds didn't see, you know, the things that people saw in Wall Street bets. I'm surprised that someone at another fund or a trader or something, or I guess they are traders, but, you know, something, you know,
another big fund doing the short squeeze play here?
Yeah, they could have easily done it. I mean, I guess, you know, there are lots of quirks and opportunities out there. And the fact that some people in Wall Street Bets saw it, like, I think, well, that's really clever, you know? So it really takes someone who's looking hard.
I'm hesitant to refer to. So on the one hand, I don't think this is an event that's going to, you know, drastically change the financial markets forever. I think we'll see some things shift around, but this isn't. I wouldn't say that this is a major turning point.
Unless
you work in this specific narrow sector of the market. The media coverage that this has gotten is vastly blown out of proportion to how much most Wall Street people care about what happened. This happened in a very narrow space of the markets, and you know it certainly had a big impact on some people, but most funds were pretty much untouched by this in a meaningful way.
Yeah, but it still is big news, and it still is. I think. It could be indicative of a little of like financial bubble conditions, just like long-term capital management was in kind of a bubble market. We could be in a little bit of a, again, I'm not like an expert on these things. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go too far out of my lane, but you know, could we be in some kind of a monetary bubble because, you know, we have COVID and, you know, we have all of this stimulus printing and we have years and years of low interest rates and, you know, the conditions of the market. Now, again, could this happen in normal conditions of the market? Maybe it could. But I feel like it's more likely when some things in the big picture are out of whack.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
I don't know enough to make the determination. Is this a sign of there were major flaws in the market, or is this just the market working as it should, where this group identified an inefficiency in the market, they exploited it, and now they're returning the market back to its natural equilibrium as a result of that, having fixed the inaccurate pricing.
Yeah, eventually could. I mean, some people have said.
I'm pretty confident that GameStop has not settled back to its true value, but I think it will eventually.
No.
It has to.
It
needs, you know, a couple of weeks or months to get back to that, but it will. I'm fairly confident.
Here's an easy question. You know, what do you do if you are, you know, the leadership of one of these companies. Like, you got in, you're the CEO of GameStop, and you're like, I don't know if the management team at GameStop actually cares about video games, but they might. You know, so they're like, they're gaming people and they're business people, but they don't, they're like, what, we they didn't teach this in business school. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is one of the dangers of being a publicly traded company, is that things can happen, that are not directly under your control, that throw everything out of whack, out of perspective.
Yeah. So I suggested that, and I found out that this is like really hard to do, probably almost impossible to do. But I was like, well, why don't they get together and say, we're going to issue new shares of GameStop? You know, apparently that takes a lot longer. You can't just like do it on a whim.
Yeah, that would be my assumption. But again, way outside my area of expertise there.
But if you could, they should just issue shares of GameStop, you know, raise money for the company, put it in Bitcoin, maybe, I don't know. And then when the stock price goes down, buy it back up, and then it ends up higher than it otherwise would have, and then you'd be acting in the interest of the shareholders that whole time.
Uncharted territory for sure.
Yeah. Some other stocks is happening. I don't know yet. I heard like AMC, the movie theater.
Yep, there were some bumps there.
There were some bumps there, and that could stop AMC from going out of business. They were close to going out of business from the pandemic. Maybe now they'll survive, so that's interesting. Again, this could be a symptom of the easy money economy that we have had for a long time. Some people say, like, hey, does this mean like a radical shift in the market towards decentralization and away from big funds? I think that sounds too good to be true. I think there'll always be big funds, but you know, maybe the little guy will have maybe there's more opportunities for a smaller player to get in there and gum up the works, especially with, you know, I mean, the use of an internet forum that doesn't seem very that technology doesn't seem particularly new. You know what I mean? Like, why couldn't you do this 5, 10 years ago?
But the ability to coordinate the actions of literally millions of people virtually in real time,
we had that
even though internet forums were around, you know, back in the days of BBS, it couldn't be mobilized in the way that it can now.
Right. I guess. Maybe in the last 10 years.
Then
or so,
I think the numbers were something like Wall Street Bets had you know 4 million members, you know, back before this hit the front page of the newspapers in January.
But let me ask you this then: why not 5 years ago?
Well, I think there are two pieces there. One is the Robinhood app, which made for an easy point of entry for a lot of people. And I was going to say, it's not just the 4 million people that were in there at the beginning of January. It's the probably millions more who saw the story, whether they heard about it, you know, through the grapevine or through Reddit, or when it, you know, people on NPR and the New York Times started talking about it. But it was easy enough for them to jump on the bandwagon before it was over. And you know the whole concept of a meme stock is a lot more movable. You know, doing a pump and dump through your newsletter is a lot harder to scale to this level than when you can not only use, you know, Reddit and Twitter, but also they essentially weaponized the media here, because that drove the message even further and got more people to jump in on it.
I mean, weaponizing the media and making them a useful idiot to your plans is sort of something that we've seen a lot of.
I mean,
the last
if they're
going
to be a force for destruction, at least I'd like to be able to point them in a direction I'd like.
Yeah. So speaking of meme stock, you know, there's a meme coin too, Dogecoin.
Oh, Dogecoin is like one of the OG coins. It goes way back.
Yeah, so it's I used to mine it, and I think I lost the ones that I mined, or maybe I didn't. But anyway, I think I only mined a handful. So, people are like, it might go to a dollar, whereas, you know, that's not going to be. Unfortunately, that's not going to pay the bills for me,
especially with the dollar decreasing in value.
Yeah, well, yes, I think I mined three Dogecoin. No, I think I mined a fraction of a Dogecoin. So if Dogecoin goes to, you know, $100,000, let me know. I'll go to the dump and try to get my. What I would have to do is go through all my hard drives or whatever. So anyway, that's been having a little bit. So that was a meme coin back in like 2014, maybe. And it was like the number three coin at some point. And it's not really, it's not hard money like Bitcoin, because the schedule is they issue a lot of it, you know? So it's like, there's always going to be more made. It's not very, the supply is not very limited. So that sort of limits how high the price could go, but it's the quintessential meme coin. And it did shoot up, through all this like collective action on Reddit and stuff recently. And then Elon Musk tweeted about it because he likes to, you know, make these things happen. And you got a big Dogecoin bump. So these things are happening all over the place.
It's interesting times.
Yeah. I think that's the theme of the episode. Interesting times. I don't know what to call this episode. I'm still kind of up in the air about it, but I guess we'll figure it out offline. Any ideas? what's the overriding theme of this episode?
Oh, overriding theme.
Yeah.
Where are we going? Nobody knows.
Yeah. That's I'm trying to think of something a little bit more certain than that. Nothing certain but uncertainty. No, we'll figure it out. All right. Yeah. So bottom line is, if I had to summarize, the changes to our financial and economic system are, there is a tsunami on the horizon, and we see it coming closer and closer to our shore. And we have some, we're experiencing some big waves first, and we're like, was that the tsunami? And no, it's like the small tsunami, and the bigger one is still out there. Whoa. So that's going to crash in a few years, and we will be along for the ride, if I could use that, if that metaphor has landed properly.
Well, now I am well and truly terrified, so thank you for that.
All right. Next week on The Local Maximum, we're going to talk about a big change in my life. So get ready for that. All right. Any last thoughts, Aaron?
No, I'm just worried about this Bitcoin tsunami that's coming.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Get your, I don't know how you prepare for it.
A Bitcoin umbrella?
Bitcoin umbrella with all your funds. All right. We'll call it a day, and have a great week, everyone.
That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.